Hello, I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind. Tonight, we'll be exploring a topic that is relevant to all of us. How do we change mentally and emotionally over our lifespan? Are there changes that affect all of us in similar ways as we age? How do historical and cultural influences affect our development? Tonight, my guest and I will be focusing primarily on the years we call middle age and old age, since in all probability, our listeners are likely to be in that time of life, and so am I. And so are the other people in the room tonight. So with me in the studio to enlighten us on lifespan development is Dr. Diane DiGiulio, a clinical psychologist who practices neuropsychology here in Juneau. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you.
Now, you're fairly new to Juneau, and I'm just curious, whenever we've got newcomers, and I know you didn't move yesterday, but how long ago did you come here?
I moved up in May of 2010.
Oh, okay. Not that new. Couple of years.
Couple of years.
Well, I guess I think you're new because I haven't met you before, which
yes.
is too bad, but now I have. So what brought you here?
Well, my husband always wanted to live in Alaska from the time that he was a young man, and I've always wanted to live on the ocean.
Oh.
And this position came up in Juneau, and my husband applied for it at Bartlett Hospital, and we came up and met people and had a tour of Juneau and thought it was absolutely beautiful, and he decided to take the position.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. And so now you're in private practice.
I am.
As a neuropsychologist, and we might mention that a little bit later, but I'd like to explore another aspect of your career, which is as a college professor. I understand that you've taught courses on lifespan development. How did you become interested in this field?
Well, I had been teaching psychopathology and child psychopathology for graduate students and teaching neuropsychology seminar to psychiatry residents. And after a while practicing and teaching it, I felt that I was just too much involved in everything that goes wrong in human development. So I had this opportunity to teach at a local technical college. And initially, they recruited me to teach abnormal psychology, and I talked them into letting me teach normal development.
Okay.
And I took off from there, and it was a great experience.
Another thing you mentioned that even preceded that, I think, is how you move from one career to another. And you told me at lunch the other day that you were working as a respiratory therapist. You were a respiratory therapist, and you were concerned about the great divide between behavioral medicine or, say, psychology and physical medicine. And that inspired you maybe to go into psychology and get a PhD?
That's what originally inspired me, is seeing the gap between attending to people's emotional and psychological needs in a hospital setting, as opposed to just focusing on their medical needs. So that's what initially drew me into the field, although I didn't stay in behavioral medicine.
Yeah, yeah. Well, years ago, I used to teach child and adolescent development at University of Alaska Southeast here. There was no course that we called adult development. And as I remember from the field, really on human development courses, we pretty much stopped at 21 or so. Now I'm noticing new lingo, lifespan psychology. So tell me how did that change from just covering infancy, childhood, and adolescence to now cover the whole lifespan?
Well, much like you, when I originally studied development as an undergrad, the textbook stopped after adolescence, and maybe there was a short couple of paragraphs on early adulthood, but pretty much you were considered to be a finished being by the time you reached early adulthood. And then there were a few theorists that focused on middle age and late adulthood, and that was somewhat discussed in earlier chapters, but there wasn't any real research interest. There weren't a lot of studies that were going on looking at middle adulthood and later aging. And I think as the population itself changed and more people were living longer and passing through middle age, there was more of a demand to look at development during that period. And a lot of studies started to take off. And people who had been studying middle development and aging previously, well, suddenly there was a lot more funding for this. Mm. And I think largely based on the fact that the population of people within the middle age group was expanding.
And fascinated about their own changes. Really fascinated. And I think there are so many more books on middle age, and particularly on aging. I notice as I'm aging, I'm reading a lot of books on the subject. I'm fascinated with it because it's happening to me. One of the things I thought about was how the era, I want to take a look at some of the cultural or historical influences on development, and then we'll get later on in the program, we'll talk about the biological changes, especially in the brain. But right now, you know, we're the baby. Well, I'm pre-baby boomer. You're a baby boomer, right?
Yes, I am.
You were a baby boomer. And if you take a look at, say, the history of adolescence, for example, we know that back at the turn of the century, it wasn't assumed that adolescence was this latent period, this time when you stayed home and you got to play sports and you got to do whatever you wanted and go to summer camp. And then you get, if you're lucky from an up middle class family or above, you got to go to college. Man, when you were 16, you might get married and go off to work. So like adolescence didn't even exist. Okay. So that would change, of course, the view of development. Now, or people born during the Depression would have very different ideas about saving money than folks who were born and grew up after the Depression. So the largest cohort in U.S. history is currently moving through middle age. Just as you said, the baby boomers born between 1946 and 1964 officially. So how are they different? What characterizes baby boomers? Do you have any idea?
Well, they're considered to be the best educated population that we've ever had in American society. They're the largest group to currently reach middle age and start to enter older age. They're the most affluent. They've had the most complexity in terms of the various occupations and fields that they've worked in. There's more professional people in that particular cohort than there ever was before.
More doctors, lawyers, teachers.
Many different professions.
Yeah, you name it. Respiratory therapists, nurses. Yeah.
They're in all the fields, and they're very well educated. Their children are also well educated. And they have a great emphasis on maintaining their youth, maintaining their cognitive activity.
Exercise. Like, did our parents exercise?
Well, I was recently reading a book where someone was talking about how in his mother's day and age, it would have been considered obscene for his mother to be running down the street in a jogging suit and sneakers.
That's right.
And how the baby boomer generation changed that.
Yeah. And when you speak of professions, because I just preceded the baby boomers, and when I went back to my high school reunion several times in Chicago, I found that I was one of, and I was from a big high school, like 400 people, I found out that I was one of the few women who had a profession. And I'm including all the above, nurses, respiratory therapists, anybody who had to go on to education beyond high school for their career. Very few women. And also, I was before Title IX, which some of you may know is legislation that required equality in high school sports for boys and girls. So when I was in high school, there were no women's girls sports. You know, maybe an intramural volleyball team. But basically, girls were not physically active. And so it's very, very different.
We did folk dancing in my high school.
Girls. We did ballroom dancing. I remember ballroom dancing. Oh, boy. That was something. What about Gen X? Or what are the other cohorts called? We've got nicknames for them. Do you know of any others?
The 20-somethings?
Yeah. Well, like, how did they, you know, so kids our children's age in their 20s and 30s, I'm wondering how they will be different from, say, the baby boomers. It's going to be harder economic times, I presume. It won't be so easy to get a job. The baby boomers, one of the reasons they got to boom is the economy was booming.
Yes. And also, the generation that's coming up behind the baby boomers has seen grandparents lose retirement funds, lose positions, companies closing. There was a concept that if you worked for a company most of your life, you would then be supported in your retirement. So there was a sense of loyalty and commitment. And it's been said that that generation isn't exposed to that concept. And if anything, they've seen a lot of loss in position, loss of income, and really betrayal of people's loyalty.
And, you know, also I'm thinking about college majors. I read an article that said that currently more college undergraduates are choosing what we used to call practical majors, you know, like what would be nursing or mechanical engineering, something that's very practical. And I remember when I entered college, I gave absolutely no thought to whether the degree I got would earn me money. I was so confident. So I was a French major without a teaching certificate. So you can imagine how many jobs I was offered. Zero. That's why I went to graduate school. The other thing that is different, and let's go way back, say, to the turn of the previous century, 1900. Before the 20th century, most adults died before they reached middle age. And now the average, or reached 65, I should say. Now the average life expectancy has increased 31 years since 1900. It's now 80 years life expectancy for women and 75 years for men. So since people live so much longer, how does that affect what we think of as middle age?
It keeps being pushed back.
So good, I can still say I'm middle-aged.
You can.
Yay.
You can. It keeps being pushed back. And many people who are in their later 60s, who are cognitively stimulated and remain active physically, view themselves as being in middle age.
Yeah.
Even though the textbooks say that middle age starts at 40, 45 and ends at 60, 65.
You know, I think no 45-year-old would ever say they were middle-aged.
I don't think they would either.
It's really, and do you remember the famous Gloria Steinem statement? You know, when people said, I think it was for her 50th or was it her 60th birthday, but you know how beautiful Gloria Steinem is. And so they were commenting on, oh, you're so beautiful for, let's say, 50. And she said, this is what 50 looks like. And if I know Gloria Steinem, who I have met, and I chauffeured around Seattle one time, she would not get a facelift, I'm sure. Okay, so that's that. Well, if you're Gloria Steinem, that's what 50 looks like. For most of us, we don't look like that. Do you think there's anything true about what has been called a midlife crisis? You know, like that suddenly at midlife, the majority of people question, you know, what am I doing with my life?
You know, Elaine, it's not really discussed in the textbooks that I've used, but one of the things that I've always thought of is that during the time when there was a midlife crisis, when it was being studied, I think that it was largely occurring because the culture was very youth-oriented at that time, and people were expected to retire, and I think that it was largely about men, the midlife crisis. I think that they had reason to be in crisis. We went through a period in history where people in their 50s were being replaced by younger, more educated professionals that were coming into different fields of management. And there still wasn't a concept in the culture that if you exercised and stayed in shape and stayed cognitively stimulated, that you continued to make gains, that you continue to develop expertise. And I think there is reason to feel that once you reached your 50s, you were on a decline, because that's what people were being told. That's what people believed.
When I look in our family album that goes way back, goes back over 100 years, the matrons, the women at 50 look and dressed 70. Do you have the same thing? I mean, it's totally amazing. Because I know my grandmother, when she died, my grandmother died young, and she was around 50, and she looked old. And you know, she died suddenly of heart attack, so it wasn't that she was suffering from a disease. Another thing that is going on, I think, for people in middle and particularly later years, and I'd say the later years, you know, say 65 and over, is rapid technological change. I think this is really hard on folks, and I will include myself. I think one of my great fears is that I won't be up to snuff technologically, particularly around communication with other people, and everything changes so rapidly. And we all know the 85-year-old grandma who isn't on email, and so she's supposedly missing out on all the fun because she can't get on Facebook and see her grandkids. But indeed, in a book that was written by an MIT psychologist called Alone Together, I don't know if you've read that, she's a social psychologist, and she wrote about the impact of social media and how young people, I guess teens and 20s, are very uncomfortable talking on the phone compared to older people. Earlier generations, they're much more comfortable with texting. And what I've noticed is when I call people of that age range, they often don't have their voicemail set up on their cell phone.
That's true.
And they often don't check. They never answer. So when this MIT research interviewed a bunch of teenagers and young adults, they spoke, and this I found very interesting, and this is a huge cohort difference. They said, why do you want to use the phone? It like intrudes on people, and then you have to answer it. And frankly, they say, I don't know what to say, and I don't know how to get off the phone. And I was thinking, when you use the phone, you learn telephone etiquette and telephone savvy. In other words, you know to say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't talk right now, I'm right in the middle of something. Or you say, is this a good time to talk? And these young people didn't get that experience and find phoning very difficult. And I know my own kids who are in their 20s wish I texted. And I don't. And I don't because this is generational. I don't like it. And so I think technological change and how rapid it is would really set 8 cohorts apart. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I would have to agree with you. It does. And I think that social skills are different between a group that isn't comfortable conversing over a telephone, having a sustained conversation. But I also think that they've developed other skill sets that we don't have. And it's been said that they don't give as much attention, concentrated effort to detail. But I didn't find that when I taught college. I thought that they were very good at multitasking. I don't know that they have the same depth that we might have if we put more concentrated effort into something. But I am impressed with how quickly they can look something up and report on it.
The research I've read, and you'd know perhaps more about this, is that there's been lots of research on attention, the ability to pay sustained attention. And the more time people spend on the computer, whatever age they are, the less able they are to pay attention. And I remember some early research before Internet that came out, and it was the same thing about TV. The more you watch TV with that rapid change of scene, the harder it was to pay attention to something long. And so that might be another difference, which is a love of books, a love of being able, the ability, just the cognitive ability to sustain one's attention through a difficult book. When I say difficult, I mean something that's deep.
A Russian novel.
And I often think about my book group, and will there be book groups 20 years hence? We'll see.
There will be, but they won't meet in person to discuss the book. They'll text.
Oh, how sad. I love meeting in person. You can't. Well, anyways, we'll go on to the next topic, the sandwich generation. You had mentioned that to me. And could you talk a little bit about what that means?
Well, people in middle age sometimes find themselves caring for both their young adult children, who may continue to need financial support or come back to live in the home to save money to further their education, while simultaneously they're also taking care of aging parents. So they have responsibilities for two different populations, as well as carrying on in their own careers or carrying on in their own interests. And so that's a particular form of stress that hasn't been experienced by previous generations that move through middle age.
And, you know, don't you think the increasing age of marriage would affect that? Because I know when my oldest son got married, I was no longer in the same role with him. He had a wife. Now he has three children. He is definitely independent on his own. It felt very different. Of course, when he married, he was in his 20s, and that was a big shift. And so now a lot of couples are not getting married, and so it's a different arrangement. It doesn't feel quite as solid to their parents, and they're delaying marriage. So there's that endless, you know, youth, I think they called it, Peter Pan syndrome for men who just kind of, you know, were ski bums their whole life. So then it's kind of a childlike aspect that would occur. And that's a shift, especially with the affluence of the parents, because it's our generation that's raising kids who are delaying their marriage, and they grew up in more affluent situations than the parents themselves did earlier. So perhaps more of a sense of play, you could call it entitlement, not a need to get down to it.
And also more of a sense of exploration, that you can explore different educational opportunities, explore different career opportunities, work in a field for a while,
yes,
decide whether or not you like it, rather than the way that we were raised, where you decided what it was you were going to do when you grew up, when you were in high school. We had high school guidance counselors whose job it was to help you find what your career was going to be.
We took tests. Do you remember did you ever take a career test?
I don't recall. It's too long ago.
All I remember is whatever it came out with, I took one when I was a teenager or a young adult. And whatever it came out with, I said, no way, I don't want to do that. I forget what it was, but it wasn't something I wanted to do. Yeah. Well, I have an idea. Let's take a short music break, and Dolly and John, our technicians, have chosen some good music, and then Dr. Diane DiGiulio and I will be back to talk about the cognitive changes that occur as we age.
Cada um ter sua visão, sem condição, só na emoção, pra ser feliz sem resistir, de um puro não pra explicar essa tua intenção, mas sem contenção de emoção, sem contenção. prata puxando, não quero ver nem mais sentir. Cabe a razão de cada um ter sua visão. Toco a canção sem coração, mordendo o tempo sem sentir. Sendo uma pura ilusão, só viver de emoção.
Back to our discussion about how adults change emotionally and mentally as they age. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio is Dr. Diane DiGiulio, a clinical psychologist who practices neuropsychology here in Juneau. We've just been discussing historical and cultural influences on adult development, especially focusing on middle age and older. Now, what I'd like to do is pick Dr. DiGiulio's brain and look at how the brain changes with aging and how our mental abilities are affected. So, Dr. DiGiulio, what are some of the cognitive changes that occur with aging?
Well, it's pretty much accepted that there is a change in our ability to engage in executive functioning as we age.
Meaning, executive functioning?
Well, executive functioning involves things like cognitive flexibility, being able to generate a lot of responses, as well as being able to inhibit automatic or inappropriate responses. These are all things that are controlled by frontal executive functioning, rapid decision making,
good judgment,
abstract reasoning, aspects of it. Those are the kinds of things that tend to decline with age, but the original research looked at two different cohort groups, and as we were just discussing, that the cohort group that is coming through middle age and going into later adulthood now is a different population than the generation before. They're better educated. They've developed their cognitive skills to a much higher degree. So the original research that looked at, compared two different cohorts, came to the conclusion that there was cognitive decline going on in middle age. But other studies that look at lifespan longitudinally, looking at the same group assessed over time, does not show that there are cognitive changes that indicate decline in middle age. It's pretty much accepted at this point that there is some memory loss, but that tends to occur at the later end of middle age, more approaching the early part of late adulthood.
Which would be specifically?
Probably in the late 60s, early 70s, but it's a very modest decline.
Modest memory loss. Even though all my friends who are, not all my friends, but most of my friends who are between, say, 55 and 70, that's a big swath, everybody jokes about and makes comments about how they can't remember a thing. So it seems like anecdotally there's significant memory loss. What do you think? Because the research doesn't bear that out?
Well, it doesn't. And I think that what people might be confusing is whether or not they have real memory impairment versus the ability to retrieve information that they already know. And memory retrieval does slow in later adulthood. But if you ask your friends about remembering something, they may not be able to bring it to the forefront of their mind immediately, but they'll remember it later. But in true memory loss, they don't remember it later.
But I thought there was, you know, recent memory and long-term memory, and that I know with dementia, recent memory is greater, more greatly affected than long-term memory. But I thought that in normal aging, and this, again, is anecdotal because this is what everybody kind of talks about, is they can't remember where they put their glasses. They can't, you know, forgot that they put the coffee to heat up in the microwave. And they make a trip down to the basement, and once they get there, they can't figure out why they're there. All that seems to be very common and significant. Do you think by any chance people have a heightened fear of memory loss because of now the ubiquitous information about dementia and Alzheimer's? I mean, ads in the newspaper, ads in magazines for Aricept and all those kinds of things. Do you think it's just kind of a heightened awareness of that?
Well, certainly that plays a role in people being concerned. But I think that what many people experience is the change and how easy it was for them to multitask when they were younger and keep a lot of different things in their forefront of their mind at once, which actually is what we call working memory. And that is affected by the aging process. It's the ability to have a number of things going on at once in the forefront of your mind and to keep tracking them. That's working memory.
Yeah.
That does decline with age. But it isn't true dementia that involves memory loss in terms of not being able to learn new information and to store it. It's all there.
Okay, I thought I read that the ability to learn new things decreased in older age.
It takes longer.
It takes longer. And I think people get frustrated.
Requires more repetition.
And this brings us back to the technology of needing your own kid to come over and program your TV set. You know,
They're complicated TV sets.
They are very complicated. And I notice in some of the magazines I read, they sell simplified cell phones. Have you seen any ads for that?
Okay. But maybe I'll get one.
If you get ARP or probably even the New Yorker, you know, people of a certain age read those magazines, there'll be not only bathtubs that have little doors in them so you can walk out, you don't have to worry about standing up, but there's also these very simple cell phones that have no gizmos. You basically just call. Because some of the gizmos drive people crazy. As a neuropsychologist, you do a lot of testing.
I do.
And do you test for dementia?
Absolutely.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about what you look at when you're testing for dementia.
Well, I look at executive functioning by giving a number of different tasks that are thought to tap into executive functioning. Mostly the ones that I use are looking at being able to generate a lot of responses within a given category, being able to switch back and forth between two different tasks rapidly under time conditions, being able to inhibit an automatic response.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some tasks of executive functioning. And we also look at verbal memory and visual memory in
which
a number
like
of different ways.
Like word recall?
Wordless or logically related verbal information,
mm-hmm.
or designs, or being able to look at a spatial array and be able to duplicate it. So we're tapping into both verbal and visual memory to see if there's a difference. And we look at how people perform following immediate exposure and then after a delay interval of, let's say, 20, 30 minutes, how much of the information stayed with them.
I read that there's, among normal aging adults, not people with dementia, but normal aging adults, that those with a higher level of education tend to have less memory loss than those with a lower level of education.
That's true. And it's thought to be the case because they're more actively using their cognitive skills on a daily basis. People who are well-educated that have done well professionally or through their educational process like to use their mental abilities, and they continue to use it and to have discussions and to have book groups,
mm-hmm.
to discuss what's going on in the world, to generate a lot of thought about what's going on in the world and what they think, and they want to share that information, and that keeps them cognitively stimulated.
And I think the same article, a research article, talked about adults who work in, say, the teaching profession, professions that require continuous upgrading of knowledge, fare better with memory when they're older than those who work in more service positions that don't require continuing education and that kind of thing, which goes along with educational level as well, of course. And this brings us to the fascinating Nunn study and dementia. And I read about that a long, long time ago, and it really impressed me. See if I have this correct. The background was that there was an order of nuns, I think, in Wisconsin or Minnesota. I think it was Minnesota, where many years ago in the 90, so when they were novices and they were entering nunhood, they were tested. They were all tested, and those with a greater verbal acuity based on their essays that they wrote, a richness of language, tended to significantly have less dementia as they aged than those with a lower verbal ability.
And also the ones that taught.
So does this have to do with, like, we have more reserve? We have more that we can lose, so therefore there's more left over, even if plaque forms?
I think that's part of it.
Is there anything people can do, just normal people, that, I mean, first of all, in your opinion, and then secondly, I'd like to know if there's any research on it, but from what you have learned about dementia, do you think there's anything we can do to reduce our risk or delay the onset of Alzheimer's?
Well, I think that probably if you're genetically predisposed to develop an early form of dementia, that most likely that will happen. And I think that the things that you can do might somewhat mitigate against the severity of it, perhaps, or delay it somewhat. And those are the things that that have been talked about that we already know about that have to do with diet, exercise, and staying cognitively stimulated, continuing to use your abilities. But I think for people that are biologically predisposed by virtue of their heredity, mm-hmm. that they're going to be affected. mm-hmm. but maybe less so.
Mm-hmm. Or at a later age, which is less so. How does exercise impact the brain so that it might
You know, I'm not really sure.
Okay, sure. Let's talk a little bit about stress and aging and the impact of stress. I've been fascinated by some research that several years ago won the Nobel Prize, actually, it was an American scientist, and she must have been a neuroscientist, about telomeres, and which are the tips of our chromosomes. And the research showed that, well, first of all, telomeres are very important for really indicating how healthy we are and how long we're going to live. It's kind of a single index of that. And then subsequently has done a lot of work on the impact of stress on telomeres. And basically, the longer your telomeres, the healthier you are, and the longer you're going to live, and the shorter your telomeres are, the opposite. And that there was a she conducted a study comparing women, I believe, who were caretakers of either a disabled parent or a disabled child, which that was defined as one of the highest stress experiences or activities you could do, versus a control group exactly like that group, except they weren't taking care of a handicapped person. And the difference was enormous. Something like the stress in that case took off years of the person's life. And with all that we've been talking about, if we take a broad sweep and take a look at how people's lives have changed, were people less stressed at the turn of the century? Was stress less of a cause? I know we have improvements in modern medicine, but I wonder if sometimes they're offset by, you know, Americans work more hours than anywhere else in the developed world. I mean, it's pretty stressful. And all this information coming in, busy, busy, busy. What do you think?
Well, I think that our lives are more complex, in part because we have more choices and we have more opportunities. And so we're always weighing what we can accomplish against what we should accomplish. And I think that at the turn of the century, particularly for women, there were clear paths to follow. And there's a certain amount of security and peace of mind that comes from not having a lot of choices, even though none of us today would want that for ourselves. But there has to be a certain serenity in knowing that I'm going to do this at this age, that at that age.
You know, that's so funny because my wonderful mother-in-law, Evelyn Schroeder, said to me sweetly one time, she said, "You know, I don't envy you girls who have careers and are mothers too. Back when I was raising my family, I knew all I had to do was just take care of the kids and the household." And she said, "I think it would be very stressful to also have a career." So she saw what was going on with me and with her kids, how difficult it was, for women particularly.
Yes.
And that's another cohort change. We get the benefit of having careers, and then look what happens when we try to raise children as well. It's a huge amount of stress for women, particularly, I think.
It is.
So it is interesting, the impact on the brain of stress. Did you have that topic at all in the course you taught? The impact on cognition?
I think that the last time I taught it, we had covered a section on how cortisol levels rise when a person is under stress, and how as we age, it takes longer for those levels to go back down to baseline. So it's harder to recover from experiencing daily stress in middle age and in older age than it is when you were younger.
Yeah, good. Why don't we take another short break with some good music? And then Dr. Diane DeGiulio and I will be back to talk about something a little more general, the emotional changes and emotional intelligence and wisdom that may change over the years. So let's have some music. Welcome back to our discussion about how we humans change emotionally and cognitively as we age. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio is Dr. Diane DeGiulio, a clinical psychologist who has a private practice in neuropsychology here in Juneau. We've just been talking about the cognitive changes and the thinking abilities that don't change as we age. So now what I'd like us to do is turn philosophical and take a look at the emotional changes, our state of being, how we feel as we age, including attitudes about the meaning of our life and our own mortality. So, welcome back. And I was just wondering, Diane, do you feel, and I don't know if this is going to be a scientific question or just your personal opinion, that people get wiser as they get older?
I think that certainly there are groups of people who do.
Mm-hmm.
They continue to refine their expertise in particular areas,
mm-hmm.
and they increase their skill set and have a lot more to offer in terms of teaching that to their own children or to the generation that comes up behind them. And I think that the idea that we value people with expertise that are aging within our American population is a new idea for us.
I know. I think sometimes I like going to a lawyer or a doctor or even a car mechanic who's a little bit older. I don't want to go to a 25-year-old. I want to go to a 55-year-old or thereabouts. I just figure that accumulated experience would have them know their field. But let's take a look at more of an aspect of wisdom, which is about insight into the human condition, the wisdom to know how to deal with life's ups and downs. Daniel Goleman wrote a wonderful book called Emotional Intelligence, and I think that's another way to take a look at wisdom. It involves good judgment. It involves emotional stability, not being triggered easily, but being calm. And according to some things I've read, it seems like research indicates that people, older people, have increased emotional intelligence. Now, that's not exactly the same as wisdom. That same research talked about if you have worked in a field that is concerned with difficult life problems, that even predicted a greater level of emotional intelligence. Think about it. It's very interesting. Right now I'm reading a book, a memoir, and in it a very privileged woman who grew up and went to Harvard and grew up in a blue blood family, had an early experience of working in a refugee camp, and that changed her life forever. And she went on to basically dedicate her life to helping people less fortunate than herself. And so many of us have thought that wisdom or emotional intelligence is connected with considering the welfare of others rather than a kind of me first attitude. And I just would say, without even knowing if there's been extensive research on this issue, it just appears that the older we get, the more likely we are to get it. And get it, which is, where does true happiness come from? And that's what I call really wisdom. Is it chasing after the big buck? Or is it human relationships and love?
So I would call that successful aging, for sure.
Ah.
To be able to sort it out and to find meaning and to know what's most important to you.
That's interesting. Meaning, finding meaning. And that, I wonder what that means to you and to me and to the people who are listening this evening. Finding meaning in our life. And I lead the bereavement group for hospice in Juneau, and what I've noticed is that either when the parents or the spouses of the deceased, who are in my group, of course, talk about the person who died, people can die with great bitterness, and people can die with calmness, as my mother did, even at 63, Well, I'll just talk about my mom for a second. She really felt, even at 63, which is pretty darn young, she was a wonderful mother, and that was her role. Now, she also did a lot of community volunteering, and she worked with orphans, and she did, you know, she did that. But she had a normal life, and she was a good woman. When she died, she was accepting of it. And I remember when she died of breast cancer, and I remember when she was pretty much on her last legs because it had spread, of course. And she looked up at my brother and me, and she said, "It was really worth it just to have you two."
Oh.
Can you believe that? I mean, and the
how
only
kind.
Reason she didn't mention my father is he had died 9 months earlier of a stroke, and they had a wonderful marriage. So I just, you know, she would have included him.
Had he been there.
Had
to
he been there.
To receive the compliment.
And
how gracious of her.
Oh, absolutely. So as we age, we are much more aware of our mortality. And it's an interesting exercise to think, what would I do if I had 1 year to live? And I think the older we get, the more likely we are to realize we only may have 1 year to live. And what's really important? I know one thing. I'll tell you if it's hit me. I only want to read good books, meaning I don't just want to read books, but I want to, as far as the books I read, I want them to be good books. And I kind of get mad at myself if I, you know, waste my time before I go to bed reading the Eddie Bauer catalog. I mean, I just got to stop that. So from a lifespan development perspective, what do you think? I mean, does anything come to mind for you about, you know, that changes? I mean, these aren't neurological changes, but anything that you think about that there's tends to be more being at peace with yourself? No, is there any research on that, knowing how to be in the world, not being so agitated or labile?
Well, what comes to mind for me is Erik Erikson's two final stages of lifespan development. For middle age, it's generativity versus stagnation. And for late adulthood, it's integrity versus despair. And it sounds like you're tapping into the idea of integrity versus despair, which considers how it is that you do a life review and decide. And it sounds like your mom was doing that on her own without any guidance. She was reviewing her life and looking at what she had accomplished and having a sense of integrity about it and feeling very positive that her life had been worthwhile.
And, you know, she had grown up very poor in the Depression.
Yes.
And we were middle class by the time she died. And I think she also really appreciated that. That her circumstances, her life was much better than probably her parents' life had been. And she was able to, rather than be greedy for more, able to practice gratitude. And those are all qualities that come with wisdom.
And it must have been a wonderful thing for someone who grew up as your mom did to see her children become so successful. What pride she must have taken in you and your brother.
Yes, you're exactly right. She was so proud, very proud. Well, we are going to need to wind up in just a minute. I really love ending on this note, and this is a great way to end lifespan development because we're right down to the last days of somebody's life. And what can prompt all of us to practice gratitude and live the life that we feel has integrity now. It's not about the bucket list. I actually don't like the term bucket list because it's all about me. What I'd rather have is, you know, my bucket list is to go help somebody else. Maybe that brings much more happiness. But I want to thank Dr. Diane DiGiulio for her insights this evening and her specialized knowledge. And I would like to thank John and Dolly Kramers, our loyal technical support team, who keep this board, the technical board side of this program flowing. And good night to you, all our Southeast Alaska listeners. Please tune in next month, Monday, August 5th, at 7 p.m. on K2. Good night, folks.
Thank you.